When a particular occupation is overwhelmingly chosen by women, such as nursing, the employer may be reluctant to hire a male nurse, regardless of that male nurse's individual qualifications. Conversely, where lumberjacks are overwhelmingly male, the employer may be reluctant to hire a female lumberjack, even if she is demonstrably as fully qualified as the man. Observers who point out that particular individuals are equally qualified, regardless of sex, miss the point. An equally qualified individual may do the work just as well as others, but if some of the others are distracted from their work, the net effect can be a less efficient workforce. That is the empirical basis that can lead employers to practice discrimination 1B in such situations, even if the employers have no bias or aversion to those less likely to be hired. Misdiagnosing the basis for discrimination produces more than a difference in words. It can produce policies less likely to achieve their goals, or even policies that make matters worse, as in the case of forbidding employers from checking criminal records of job applicants. Moreover, higher costs are not just a problem limited to employers. Others are going to have to pay the higher costs that initially fall on employers if those employers are to stay in business and continue to provide jobs. Many people do not like to hear economists say that there is no free lunch, but that does not change the reality. Employment decisions are not the only decisions affected by discrimination of one sort or another. Where there are real differences between groups, with potentially dire consequences, such as murder rates several times higher in one group than in another, discrimination 1B may be carried to the point of redlining a whole neighborhood or group, even when a majority of the group avoided are not guilty of the behavior feared. Even in a high-crime neighborhood, for example, most people are not necessarily criminals. As a personal note, some years ago, an elderly relative was crossing a busy thoroughfare alone in the Bronx when she lost consciousness and fell to the ground in a high-crime neighborhood. People on the sidewalk rushed out into the street to direct traffic around her. One of the women in the group took charge of her purse and returned it after my unconscious relative revived. Not a cent was missing from the purse. But the costs of sorting the local population individually can be prohibitively high. Therefore, decisions are likely to be made through a cruder decision-making process, relying on empirically based generalizations, discrimination 1B, rather than the more discerning but costly discrimination 1A, or an antipathy-based or bias-based discrimination 2. One of the consequences of such situations is that a law-abiding majority in a high-crime neighborhood can end up paying a high price for the presence of a criminal minority living in their midst. Some businesses will not deliver their products, whether pizzas or furniture, to high-crime neighborhoods, rather than risk bodily harm, including death, to their drivers. Taxi drivers may avoid taking passengers to such neighborhoods for the same reason, even when these are black taxi drivers refusing to go into black high-crime neighborhoods, especially at night. Supermarket chains and other businesses often avoid locating local stores in such neighborhoods for similar reasons. All this hurts law-abiding people in high-crime neighborhoods, who are, in effect, paying a price for what other people are doing. In addition to being the principal victims of criminals in their midst, they also literally pay a price in hard cash for the behavior of others, in the higher prices usually charged for goods sold in neighborhoods where there are higher costs of doing business, due to higher levels of shoplifting, vandalism, burglary, pilferage, and robbery, and higher business insurance premiums because of these and other neighborhood disorders. A study titled "The Poor Pay More" saw the poor in general as exploited consumers taken advantage of by stores located in low-income neighborhoods. This view was echoed in the media, in government, and in academic publications. Yet, because many low-income neighborhoods are also high-crime neighborhoods, the poor pay more committed an all-too-common error in assuming that the cause of some undesirable outcome can be determined by where the statistical data were collected. In this case, researchers collected price data in the neighborhood stores, but the causes of those high prices were not the people who posted those prices in the stores. Moreover, while prices were higher in inner-city, low-income neighborhood stores, rates of profit on investments in such stores were not higher than average, but lower than average, despite some people who assumed that profit rates had to be higher because of the higher prices. For people unaware of the economics of the situation, the higher prices may be seen as simply price gouging by greedy store owners, discrimination too against minority neighborhoods, and a problem that the government could solve by imposing price controls, for example, as a Harlem newspaper suggested during the 1960s furor over revelations that the poor pay more. If, however, businesses in these neighborhoods do not recover their higher costs of doing business there in the prices they charge, they face the prospect of being forced out of business by losses. There is often a dearth of businesses in low-income, high-crime neighborhoods, which would hardly be the case if there were higher rates of profit being made from the higher prices charged in such neighborhoods. It may be no consolation to those law-abiding citizens in a high-crime neighborhood that the higher prices they have to pay are reimbursing higher costs of doing business where they live. Meanwhile, politicians and local activists have every incentive to claim that the higher prices are due to discrimination, in the sense of discrimination too, even when in fact the community is simply paying additional costs generated by some residents in that community. Those local residents who created none of those costs may be victims of those who did, rather than being victims of those who charged the resulting higher prices. This is not just an abstract philosophical point or a matter of semantics. The difference between understanding the source of the higher prices and mistakenly blaming those who charged those prices, which is especially likely when most of the local businesses are owned by people who are ethnically different from the people living in the neighborhood, is the difference between doing things to lessen the problem and doing things likely to make the problem worse by driving more much-needed businesses out of the neighborhood. Although higher prices in low-income neighborhoods are often discussed in the context of racial or ethnic minorities, the same economic consequences have been found where the people in the low-income neighborhoods are white. As the Cincinnati Enquirer reported, residents of eastern Kentucky refer to the higher prices and interest rates common in their area as the hillbilly tax. Among the things that might be done to reduce the burden of unfairness to law-abiding residents of high-crime neighborhoods could be stronger law enforcement by the police and the courts. But to the extent that the public, both inside and outside the affected communities, sees the high prices as discrimination too against the affected community as a whole, due to bias or antipathy by the larger society, the imposition of stronger law enforcement could be seen as just another imposition of injustice on the affected communities. In short, whether people believe that higher prices in low-income, high-crime neighborhoods are due to discrimination 2 or to empirically based decisions, discrimination 1, matters in terms of which policies to reduce the unfair burdens on law-abiding residents are politically feasible. Community or ethnic solidarity can be a major obstacle to seeing, believing, or responding to the facts. Sidebar: factors behind price differences. Crime is not the only reason why prices are higher in many low-income neighborhoods. To someone unfamiliar with economics, it may seem strange that a store in a low-income neighborhood can be struggling to survive while selling a product for a dollar that Walmart is getting rich selling for 75 cents. But the costs of running a business are among the many things that are neither equal nor random. Walmart's costs are lower in many ways, of which safer locations are just one. Even if a local store charging a dollar is making 15 cents gross profit per item, while Walmart is making only 10 cents, if Walmart's inventory turnover rate is 3 times as high, then in a given time period, Walmart is making 30 cents selling that item, while the local store is making 15 cents. Walmart's inventory turnover rate is in fact higher than that of even some other big box chain stores, and much higher than that of a local neighborhood store, where the same item may sit on the shelf much longer before being sold. Delivery costs are also likely to be lower per item delivered to a Walmart store. For example, the cost of delivering 100 boxes of cereal to one giant Walmart store may be far lower than the cost of delivering 10 boxes of cereal to each of 10 different neighborhood stores scattered around the city. It is 100 boxes of cereal in either case, but the cost of delivering them can be very different. None of this tells us how much discrimination 1 or discrimination 2 exists in a given society, or how many disparities in outcomes are due to some other circumstances or some other decision-making process. In some situations, there may clearly be costs deliberately imposed on a group by outsiders, discrimination 2, such as denying black American citizens the right to vote in many southern states in times past. The racial segregation laws in those states, forcing black passengers to sit in the back of buses and trolleys and denying them admissions to those state universities set aside for whites only, were obvious examples of clearly racial discrimination. The original ghettos in centuries past, which forced Jews to live in a confined area and banned them from most European universities, were other examples of the same discrimination too. Innumerable other groups in countries around the world, the Untouchables in India being a classic example, faced even more and worse restrictions and oppressions. These are all costs imposed by discrimination too, and paid for by its victims. What also warrants analysis, in order to understand cause and effect, are the costs paid by the discriminators, because these costs are factors in how much discrimination too can persist in particular circumstances and institutions. Such costs have no such moral, political, or ideological attraction as the costs paid by victims, but the costs that discriminators have to pay, and the circumstances in which they do or do not have to pay those costs, can affect how much discrimination too is in fact likely to be inflicted. Understanding the costs paid by discriminators also presents opportunities for policies that can ensure that these costs cannot be evaded, as well as warnings that other policies may inadvertently free discriminators from these costs if the circumstances are not understood. Costs of discrimination. Neither the amount nor the severity of discrimination too is fixed permanently. It varies greatly from country to country and from one era to another in the same country. There was an era in which many American employers' advertisements for some jobs said, "No Irish need apply," or "Whites only." There was a time when some shops in Harlem, back when that was an upscale white community, had signs that read, "No Jews and no dogs." Nor were Americans unique. In many other places and times around the world, group discrimination, that is, discrimination too, was so pervasive and so widely understood that no such signs were necessary. For a woman, a Jew, or members of some other groups to apply for certain jobs would have been considered a presumptuous waste of the employer's time. Discrimination, too, in hiring and promotions raises questions about both causation and morality. Both kinds of questions deserve to be examined separately. Causation. In trying to understand the causes and the consequences of discrimination in hiring and promotions, it is necessary to again consider whether this is discrimination 1 or discrimination 2. This is not always an easy question to answer, and in fact, easy answers, such as automatically equating statistical disparities in outcomes with discrimination too, can be a major obstacle to getting at the truth. An employer who judges each job applicant individually, without regard to the applicant's group membership, can nevertheless end up with employees whose demographic makeup is very different from the demographic makeup of the local population. One major demographic fact that is often overlooked by those who automatically equate statistical disparities in outcomes with discrimination too is that different ethnic groups have very different median ages. Japanese Americans, for example, have a median age more than 2 decades older than the median age of Mexican Americans. Even if every individual of the same age had the same income, regardless of which group that individual was part of, nevertheless, there would still be serious disparities in income between Japanese Americans and Mexican Americans, as well as between many other groups. A group with a median age in their 20s will obviously not have nearly as large a proportion of their population with 20 years of work experience as a group whose median age is in their 40s. One group may therefore have a disproportionate number of people in high-level occupations requiring long years of experience, while the other group may be similarly overrepresented in entry-level jobs, in sports, or in violent crimes, which are all activities disproportionately engaged in by the young. Such disparities in outcomes are not automatically evidence of either outsiders' biases or internal deficiencies in the groups. Either or both may be present or absent, but that requires specific empirical evidence going beyond gross statistical differences in outcomes. In short, conditions prior to job applicants reaching an employer can have a disparate impact on the chances of someone from a particular group being hired or promoted, even if the employer judges each applicant on that applicant's own individual qualifications without regard to the group from which the applicant came. Age is just one of those pre-existing conditions. As already noted, children raised in families where the parents have professional occupations hear nearly twice as many words per hour as children raised in working-class families, and more than 3 times as many words per hour as children raised in families on welfare. Can we believe that such differences, and others, compounded over many years while growing up, make no difference in individual abilities and social outcomes when those children become adults seeking employment? All these individuals may have been very similar at birth, but many things happen between birth and applying for a job or for college admissions, and it seldom happens the same for everybody. As we have seen, it happens differently for children born and raised in the same family who happen to have been born earlier or later. Not only differences in child-rearing, but also decisions made by individuals themselves affect their outcomes. When more than 3/4 of all college degrees in education go to women, and more than 3/4 of all college degrees in engineering go to men, the statistical predominance of women in teaching and men in engineering cannot automatically be attributed to employers' biases. More fundamentally, the cause of a given outcome is an empirical question whose answer requires untangling many complex factors rather than simply pointing dramatically and indignantly to statistical disparities in outcomes, as so often happens in politics and in the media. Costs and their effects. It is easy to understand how being denied an opportunity to be hired or promoted for some jobs can lead to some groups having lower incomes than others, and why that can arouse moral objections, not only from those denied jobs, but also from others who find such practices morally repugnant. From a causal perspective, other questions arise as to the reasons for such practices. Here, the cost of discrimination to the discriminator plays a causal role in the outcome. There is also a cost for society at large. A society in which women are arbitrarily banned from many kinds of work can pay a huge cost by forfeiting the productive potential of half its population. Society, however, is seldom a decision-making unit, except perhaps at election time or during a mass uprising. To understand decisions in general, or employment decisions in particular, requires understanding the incentives and constraints confronting the particular decision-makers in particular kinds of institutions who cannot simply choose to do whatever they wish without regard to the costs of their decisions to themselves. In a competitive market for labor, or for the sale of the employer's products, The validity of the beliefs behind a business owner's decisions can determine whether that business operates at a profit or a loss, and whether it survives or is forced to go out of business. In short, we cannot simply go directly from attitudes to outcomes, even if these attitudes involve racism or sexism, as if there were no intermediate factor of costs or decisions made in a competitive market. A systemic analysis of markets cannot proceed as if there were no other factors involved besides what individual decision-makers happen to prefer. Economists who have recognized this have ranged from followers of Adam Smith to followers of Karl Marx. The point was perhaps best expressed by Friedrich Engels, co-author with Marx of the Communist Manifesto. Engels said, "What each individual wills is obstructed by everyone else, and what emerges is something that no one willed." An analysis of systemic causation is concerned with what emerges. Adam Smith, patron saint of free market capitalism, likewise had a systemic analysis of causation. He did not attribute the benefits of a capitalist economy to good intentions by capitalists. On the contrary, a case could be made that Adam Smith's view of capitalists as individuals was even more negative than that of Karl Marx. Smith and Marx reached opposite conclusions as to the benefits or harm done by free market capitalism, but neither based his conclusions on the intentions of capitalists. Each based his conclusions on the systemic incentives and constraints of economic competition. Too many other observers, including some academic scholars, reason as if intentions automatically translate directly into outcomes. Thus, in his book, The Declining Significance of Race, sociologist William Julius Wilson pointed out the various organized ways in which white Southern landowners and employers in the post-Civil War South sought to keep down the earnings of black workers and black sharecroppers. But there was no reference in that book to empirical evidence on how those intentions actually turned out. In other words, on what emerges, as Engels put it. By contrast, economist Robert Higgs, who researched the actual consequences of those efforts of white employers and landowners in the postbellum South, found that such organized efforts often collapsed as a result of competition among white employers and landowners for black workers and sharecroppers. It might seem as if newly freed blacks, desperately poor, often illiterate and unfamiliar with working as free people in labor markets, would be easy prey for whites united to enforce whatever wage and sharecropper conditions they wanted. But to expect such opportunities to prevail continuously ignores the inherent systemic competitive pressures in a market economy. In agriculture especially, and the South was largely agricultural at the time, there is an inherent urgency about getting the land plowed and the seeds planted in the spring, or else there will be no crop in the fall. Those white landowners who were the first to violate the terms to which other white landowners sought to limit the economic benefits to black workers and sharecroppers stood to be the first to assure themselves of a workforce sufficient in both quantity and quality to maximize the size of the crop that could be grown on a given piece of land. Other white landowners, who stuck by the restrictions and/or who cheated the black workers and sharecroppers in various ways, tended to find themselves having to make do with whatever quantity and quality of black workers and sharecroppers remained after other white landowners had skimmed the cream by paying higher wages and higher crop shares to improve their own prospects of a profitable crop. It is hardly surprising that organized efforts at suppressing black workers' pay and black sharecroppers' shares of their crops often broke down under such economic pressures. What emerges, in this case, was that black incomes per capita in 1900 were, at a minimum, almost half again higher than they had been in 1867-68. This represented a rate of growth higher than that in the American economy as a whole during that period. Because they started from a far lower economic level, blacks were still poorer than whites. But Professor Higgs' data indicated that black incomes grew more rapidly than white incomes over the last third of the 19th century, and about 90% of blacks lived in the South during that era. Businesses in general, whether making decisions in a labor market or a product market, are not like professors voting at a faculty meeting, because those votes seldom have any costs for the professors themselves, despite whatever good or bad results such votes may have for students or for the academic institution. The difference is the difference between decisions made subject to consequential feedback in a competitive market and decisions made with insulation from such feedback in academia and other insulated venues. South Africa under apartheid. To avoid endless and inconclusive debates about the presence or magnitude of racism, we can test our hypotheses about the costs of discrimination in a context where there is no ambiguity on the subject, namely South Africa during the era of apartheid, ruled by a white minority government, elected with the black majority denied a vote, and openly promoting white supremacy. Apartheid laws limited how many blacks could be employed in particular industries and occupations, and forbade their being hired for work above certain levels in those industries and occupations. Yet white South African employers in competitive industries often hired more blacks than they were allowed to under the apartheid laws, and in higher occupations than those laws permitted. A government crackdown during the 1970s led to hundreds of firms in South Africa's construction industry being fined for violating those laws. Nor was the construction industry the only one in which competitive businesses were fined for hiring more blacks and in higher occupations than allowed under the law. In some other industries, blacks even outnumbered whites in some particular job categories where it was illegal for blacks to be hired at all. There is no compelling evidence that the white employers violating those laws had different racial views than the white legislators who passed such laws. What was different was that employers who failed to hire black workers whom it was profitable to hire paid a price for discrimination too, in the form of lost opportunities to make money, while the legislators who passed laws imposing discrimination too paid no price at all. Indeed, legislators who failed to pass such laws would pay a price politically in a situation where only whites could vote and where white workers wanted protection from the competition of black workers. Both the employers and the legislators were rationally pursuing their own self-interests. It was just that the institutional incentives and constraints were different in a competitive market from the incentives and constraints in a political institution. Nor were labor markets the only markets affected by the costs confronting discriminators in South Africa. Apartheid laws made it illegal for non-whites to live in certain areas set aside by law for whites only. Yet many non-whites, in fact, lived in those whites-only areas. These included black American economist Walter E. Williams during a 3-month stay in South Africa doing research. There was at least one whites-only area in South Africa where non-whites were a majority of the residents. Here again, costs are the key. The costs to those owners of rental property in whites-only areas, who forfeited economic benefits available by refusing to rent to non-whites, competed with the costs of disobeying apartheid laws, and the latter did not always prevail. While racists, by definition, prefer their own race to other races, individual racists, like other people, tend to prefer themselves most of all. That is what led to widespread violations of apartheid laws by white employers and landlords in competitive industries in South Africa. It cost nothing for white South Africans to vote for candidates promoting white supremacy. But the costs of refusing to hire black workers who would make their own business profitable could be considerable. Moreover, the cost of refusing to hire blacks when other businesses competing in the product market were hiring them risked having competitors with lower prices be a threat to the survival of a business operating in a competitive market. This is not to say that discriminatory laws and policies have no effect. There are costs to disobeying laws, as well as countervailing costs to following such laws. So outcomes depend on particular circumstances in particular times and places. The costs of discrimination, too, can be far lower or even non-existent in situations where free market competition does not exist, such as in 1. Public utility monopolies, whose prices and profit rates are directly controlled by government, 2. Nonprofit organizations, and of course, 3. Government employment. In all these particular situations, discrimination too has tended to be far more common than in competitive markets, not only in South Africa under apartheid, but also in other countries around the world. Unless one believes that decision makers in these particular institutions have different racial or other views than decision makers in competitive markets, and that such differences persist over time as new generations of decision makers come and go, the reasons for such institutional differences must be sought in particular incentives and constraints growing out of differences in the circumstances of those institutions. Institutional incentives and constraints. One of the landmark struggles in the civil rights movement in mid-20th century America was a campaign against laws in most southern states mandating that black passengers sit or stand only in the back of buses, with the seats up front being reserved for whites. Although many people on both sides of this struggle regarded those laws as though they had existed from time immemorial, they had not. The history of such laws illustrates again the different roles of economic incentives and constraints versus political incentives and constraints. 3 decades after the end of slavery, laws mandating racially segregated seating in municipal transit vehicles began to be passed in many southern communities toward the end of the 19th century. The political situation had changed from that in the period immediately after the Civil War, when U.S. troops were stationed in southern states and southern governments were subject to federal policies granting blacks the right to vote during what was called the Reconstruction Era. With the end of Reconstruction and the return of local self-government in the South, blacks often lost the right to vote by methods ranging from laws to organized terrorism. Racially segregated seating on municipal transit vehicles was just one of the political consequences. Before these laws were passed, it was common for blacks and whites to sit wherever they felt like sitting on public transportation vehicles in the South. Many, if not most, of the bus and trolley companies during that era were privately owned, and their profits depended on how many people, whether black or white, chose to ride in their vehicles. The decision makers in these privately owned companies understood that they could lose profits if offending black customers by making them sit in the back or to stand when all the back seats were taken, even if there were vacant seats in the front section that was reserved for whites. Indeed, racially segregated seating could even offend some whites when all the white section seats were filled, but there were vacant seats in the section set aside for blacks. In short, racially segregated seating in municipal transit vehicles was seen by those who owned or managed such companies as something that reduced profits. Not surprisingly, municipal transit companies in the South fought against the passage of laws requiring racially segregated seating in buses and trolleys. After losing politically in the legislatures, municipal transit companies then took the issue into the courts, where they lost again. And, after the laws went into effect legally, many southern municipal transit companies simply did nothing to enforce racially segregated seating. In many places, both black and white passengers continued for years to sit wherever they felt like sitting. Eventually, however, southern government authorities cracked down. They began charging municipal transit company employees with violations of the law for not enforcing racially segregated seating, and in some cases, the owners of those companies were threatened with prosecution if those transit lines did not enforce the racial segregation laws. Only then did the laws that had been passed, in some cases years earlier, finally get enforced. Railroads were also affected economically by racial segregation laws. When black and white passengers had to be carried in separate coaches, this imposed the considerable cost of buying additional coaches for their passenger trains, as well as the further additional costs of more fuel to move the now heavier trains. This was especially costly where there were insufficient passengers to fill one coach. If there were only enough black and white passengers for the total to fill two-thirds of the seats in a coach, racial segregation laws could create a situation where there were now two coaches required, each with only one-third of the seats occupied. Like municipal transit companies, railroad managements in the South opposed the racial segregation laws in their own self-interest, even if their racial views might not have been any different from those of the politicians who passed such laws. But the incentives to which the politicians responded were votes, that is, white votes, while the incentives to which railroad owners and managers responded were financial, and money was the same, regardless of the racial source. The famous Supreme Court case of Plessy v. Ferguson in 1896 arose from the cooperation of the railroads with Homer Plessy, who was challenging these racial segregation laws, in order to create a test case. Although Plessy was part of the black community, he was genetically far more Caucasian than African, and was physically indistinguishable from white men. Had he simply gotten on a train and ridden to his destination, there was little likelihood that he would have been questioned about being seated in a railroad car set aside for whites only. But the attorneys for the railroad and the attorneys for Plessy cooperated in arranging a legal confrontation so that there would be a case to take into the courts. Unfortunately for both, and for the cause of equal rights in general, the Supreme Court majority ruled against them. There is no predestined outcome of the conflict between economic and political forces. What is important is to recognize the implications of that conflict when crafting or changing laws and policies. It is not only in political institutions, but also in some economic institutions, that decision-makers are insulated from having to pay the costs of discrimination too. Public utility monopolies, whose prices and profit rates are directly controlled by government regulatory agencies, are among the institutions insulated from paying the economic costs which a competitive market imposes on discriminatory behavior, whether directed against ethnic minorities, women, or others. Although engaging in discrimination too when hiring employees could mean lower profits for a firm operating in competitive markets, a government-regulated public utility that has a monopoly in its market would not be allowed to earn a higher profit rate than the government agency deemed proper in any case. So, a regulated public utility company is not forfeiting any additional profit that it would be allowed to keep if it hired without regard to the group from which job applicants came. Discrimination, too, might require the regulated public utility company to pay additional labor costs because of having to offer higher salaries, in order to attract a larger pool of qualified applicants, from which only applicants from groups that the decision-makers preferred would be hired. But for a government-regulated monopoly, such costs can be passed on to customers who have little choice but to pay those costs. A study of employment in government-regulated public utility monopolies, back when that included all telephone companies, pointed out that little worker recruitment was necessary to fill their jobs because, in large cities, applicants often numbered in the thousands for a few hundred openings. Generous pay and benefits also allowed such companies to cherry-pick the enlarged applicant pool for whatever kinds of personalities or other characteristics would make for a more congenial and manageable workforce. The history of the telephone industry, back when telephones meant landlines, and all the major phone companies in the United States were subsidiaries of the American Telephone and Telegraph Company, AT&T, illustrates this pattern. As of 1930, there were only 331 black women in the entire country working as telephone operators, out of more than 230,000 women in that occupation. As late as 1950, black women were still only 1% of all women working for phone companies. However, after creation of fair employment practices laws in some northern states in the 1950s, and then federal civil rights laws and policies in the 1960s, many telephone companies reversed their policies, and blacks began to be hired disproportionately. Prior to the 1960s, however, the state fair employment practices laws existed solely outside the South. Although a national sample of employment in the telephone industry showed that the employment of black telephone operators increased more than threefold between 1950 and 1960, it was 1964 before the first black telephone operator was hired by phone companies in such southern places as New Orleans, South Carolina, or Florida. Meanwhile, data from a national sample of telephone companies showed that blacks accounted for one-third of the total growth in these companies' employees from 1966 to 1968, a trend that had begun in the 1950s and was concentrated mainly in northeastern and midwestern companies. But in the South during the 1950s, in all 11 states that had once formed the Confederate States of America, the share of blacks among male employees of telecommunications companies actually declined. Since all these phone companies were owned and controlled by AT&T, such sharp regional disparities in individual phone company policies were far more consistent with regional differences between southern and non-southern state governments that regulated these companies than with policies handed down from AT&T's national management. What was consistent in all these various regions was that additional costs entailed by either preferential or discriminatory treatment of black job applicants were costs that phone companies could pass on to customers who had little choice but to pay them, since there were only landlines at the time and each phone company was a monopoly in its own area. It was much the same story in the government-regulated oil and gas public utilities at that time, where that regulation was also by state agencies, and increased hiring of blacks was confined to states outside the South during that era. These companies, too, paid no cost for discriminating against blacks before, nor any cost for preferential hiring of blacks afterwards. The same was true of decision-makers who ran non-profit organizations, or officials in charge of government hiring policies. Similar incentives produced similar outcomes in non-profit organizations such as academic institutions, hospitals, and foundations, and different outcomes in profit-based businesses operating in competitive markets. Like decision-makers in regulated public utilities, those in non-profit organizations were able to go along with whatever the prevailing opinions and pressures of the time might be, without having to worry about the costs created by discrimination too against minorities, which their institutions would have to pay. Against this background, it is hardly surprising that employment discrimination against blacks and Jews was especially widespread among colleges, universities, hospitals, and foundations until after World War II, when a revulsion against Nazi racism set in. Before that happened, however, there were 300 black research chemists employed in private businesses in the earlier era, but only 3 black PhDs in any field employed by white universities. As for Jews, they were seldom found on American college and university faculties before World War II. Although Milton Friedman had a temporary academic appointment before the war, it lasted only 1 year, despite high praise for his work by students and colleagues alike, and he spent the war years working as a statistician before eventually becoming a regular tenured professor of economics at the University of Chicago after the war. At about the same time, the University of Chicago had its first black tenured professor. The University of Chicago was exceptional only in doing such things before most of the rest of the academic world. As a personal note, the first time I encountered a white professor at a white university with a black secretary, it was Milton Friedman at the University of Chicago in 1960, 4 years before the Civil Rights Act of 1964. Decades later, after the political climate had changed considerably, colleges and universities engaged in preferential hiring of black faculty, as well as preferential admissions of black students. Again, without the academic decision-makers paying any price for their decisions, just as they paid no price for opposite policies earlier. Affirmative action in academia was sooner and more sweepingly adopted than in private industries operating in competitive markets. All this happened too fast for such sweeping policy reversals in non-profit organizations to have been due to changing personnel in the role of decision-makers. In many, if not most cases, The same decision-makers who had discriminated against blacks were now instituting preferential policies favoring blacks. In neither case was the policy necessarily due to the personal beliefs, biases, or values of the individual decision-makers, nor was the change necessarily due to Road of Damascus conversions of personal views occurring among innumerable decision-makers at the same time. Unintended consequences. In addition to laws and policies directly concerned with discrimination too, other laws and policies with very different purposes can also change the amount and impact of adverse consequences on groups defined by race, sex, or other characteristics. In short, unintended consequences can affect outcomes as readily as intended consequences, and sometimes even more so. Minimum wage laws and building restrictions are two examples among others. Minimum wage laws. Although minimum wage laws in the United States apply without regard to race, that does not mean that their impact is the same on blacks and whites alike. Where rates of pay are determined not by supply and demand in a free market, but are imposed by minimum wage laws, that can affect the cost of discrimination too to the discriminator. A wage rate set above where it would be set by supply and demand in a freely competitive market tends to have at least two consequences. One, an increase in the number of job applicants due to the higher wage rate, and two, a decrease in the number of workers actually hired due to labor's having been made more expensive. In this situation, the resulting chronic surplus of job applicants beyond the number of jobs available reduces the cost of refusing to hire qualified job applicants from particular groups, so long as the number of qualified job applicants refused employment is not greater than the number of surplus qualified applicants. When, for example, the number of qualified black job applicants refused employment can be easily replaced by otherwise surplus qualified white or other job applicants, that reduces the cost of discrimination to the discriminating employer to virtually zero. On the most basic economic principles, such a situation makes racial or other discrimination far more affordable by employers and therefore more sustainable than in a situation where wage rates are determined by supply and demand in a free competitive market. In the latter case, where supply and demand leave no chronic surplus or chronic shortage of labor, qualified black job applicants turned away have to be replaced by attracting additional other qualified job applicants from other groups by offering higher pay than what that pay would be by supply and demand in a freely competitive and non-discriminatory labor market. In other words, discrimination too has costs in a free market greater than its costs when a minimum wage law creates a chronic surplus of job applicants. Empirical evidence is consistent with this hypothesis. The prevailing national minimum wage law in the United States is the Fair Labor Standards Act of 1938. However, high rates of inflation that began in the 1940s put virtually all money wages above the level specified in that act, so that for all practical purposes, there was no minimum wage in effect a decade after the law was passed. As economist George J. Stigler pointed out in 1946, the minimum wage provisions of the Fair Labor Standards Act of 1938 have been repealed by inflation. As of 1948, during this period of no effective minimum wage law, the unemployment rates of both black and white teenagers were just a fraction of what they would become in later years, as minimum wage rates began rising in the 1950s to catch up and then keep up with inflation in later years. What is particularly striking, however, is that there was no significant difference between the unemployment rates of black and white teenagers in 1948. The unemployment rate for black 16-year-old and 17-year-old males was 9.4%. For their white counterparts, the unemployment rate was 10.2%. For 18-year-old males and 19-year-old males, the unemployment rate was 9.4% for whites and 10.5% for blacks. In short, there was no significant racial difference in unemployment rates for teenage males in 1948, when there was no effective minimum wage. After the effectiveness of the minimum wage law was restored by recurring minimum wage increases in later years, not only did teenage unemployment rates as a whole rise to multiples of what they had been in 1948, black teenage male unemployment rates became much higher than the unemployment rates for white teenage males, usually at least twice as high for most years from 1967 on into the 21st century. Labor force participation rates tell much the same story. As of 1955, labor force participation rates were virtually the same for black and white males, age 16 and 17. For 18-year-old and 19-year-old males, blacks had a slightly higher labor force participation rate than whites, as was also true of males aged 20 to 24. But this pattern changed drastically as minimum wage rates rose over the years. In the mid-1950s, black labor force participation rates for 16-year-old and 17-year-old males began falling below that of their white counterparts, and the gap grew wider in succeeding decades. For males aged 18 and 19, the same racial reversal in labor force participation rates occurred a decade later in the mid-1960s. For males aged 20 to 24, that same racial reversal occurred at the beginning of the next decade in 1970. The magnitude of the racial difference in labor force participation rates among males after the racial reversal followed the same pattern, being greatest for the 16-year-olds and 17-year-olds, less for males aged 18 and 19, and least for males aged 20 to 24. These labor force participation patterns shed additional light on the basis for racial differences in employment. If the primary reason for that racial difference in labor force participation rates was racism, there was no reason for such reversals, and especially reversals in different years and with different magnitudes for different age groups. People who are black at age 16 remain black as they get older, so there is no basis for racists to change their treatment of blacks in such patterns as black workers age. But if the real reason for these patterns was that the work experience and job skills of younger black workers made them less in demand than older black workers with more work experience and/or more job skills, then a rising minimum wage rate prices the younger blacks out of jobs first, and to the greatest extent. Unfortunately, when minimum wage laws reduced the employment prospects of inexperienced and unskilled black teenagers, that reduces their labor force participation, and therefore reduces their rate of acquisition of work experience and job skills. Whatever the degree of racism, it cannot explain age differences in employment among young black males, who do not change race as they grow older. This pattern of virtually no difference in unemployment rates between black and white teenagers, when wages were determined by supply and demand in a free market, but with large and enduring racial differences in unemployment rates when minimum wage laws became effective again, also fits the economic principle that a chronic surplus of job applicants reduces the cost of discrimination to the employer. This pattern establishes correlation between increased minimum wage rates and changing racial differences in unemployment among teenagers. If this does not conclusively prove causation, it does at least establish a remarkably persistent coincidence. Alternative explanations for these changing patterns of racial differences, such as racism, poverty, or inferior education among blacks, cannot establish even correlation with changing employment outcomes over the years, because all those things were worse in the first half of the 20th century, when the unemployment rate among black teenagers in 1948 was far lower and not significantly different from the unemployment rate among white teenagers. Building restrictions. Severe restrictions on building homes or other structures swept through various parts of the United States during the 1970s in the name of preserving open space, saving farmland, protecting the environment, historical preservation, and other politically attractive slogans. But however they were characterized, What such laws and policies did in practice was forbid or drastically reduce the building of either housing or other structures. Coastal California, including the entire peninsula from San Francisco to San Jose, was one of the largest regions where severe building restriction laws and policies arose and prevailed. The predictable effect of restricting the building of housing, as the population was growing, was a rise in housing prices when the supply of housing was not allowed to rise as the demand rose. California home prices were very similar to those in the rest of the country before this wave of building restrictions swept across the coastal regions of the state in the 1970s. But afterward, San Francisco Bay Area home prices rose to more than three times the national average. In Palo Alto, adjacent to Stanford University, home prices nearly quadrupled during the 1970s, not because more expensive homes were being built, for there were no homes built in Palo Alto during that decade. Existing homes simply skyrocketed in price. By the early 21st century, the top 10 areas of the United States with the biggest home price increases over the previous 5 years were all in California. The racial impact of these housing restrictions was more pronounced than many racially explicit restrictions. By 2005, the black population of San Francisco was reduced to less than half of what it had been in 1970, even though the total population of the city as a whole was growing. In an even shorter span of time, between the 1990 and 2000 censuses, three other California counties, Los Angeles County, San Mateo County, and Alameda County, had their black populations decline by more than 10,000 people each, despite increases in the general population in each of those counties. By contrast, Harlem was a predominantly white community as late as 1910, and there were openly proclaimed and organized efforts by white landlords and realtors to prevent blacks from moving into Harlem. But, like the organized white efforts to suppress black earnings in the postbellum South, the mere presence of such organized efforts was no evidence or proof that they achieved their goal. To call such explicitly racist efforts in Harlem unsuccessful would be an understatement. Those white landlords and realtors in Harlem who held out while others began to rent to blacks found themselves losing white tenants who moved out of the neighborhood as blacks moved in, leaving the holdouts' buildings with many vacancies representing lost rent. The collapse of these organized efforts to keep out blacks is hardly surprising under these conditions. No such economic consequences inhibited those residents and their elected officials in later years who restricted the building of housing in San Francisco and other coastal California communities through the political process, driving up home prices and rents to levels that many blacks could not afford. On the contrary, such restrictions on new building increased the market value of the existing homes of residents in those communities and permitted higher rents to be charged by landlords in a market with severe housing shortages. Attitudes and beliefs, however strongly held or loudly proclaimed, do not automatically translate into end results, into what emerges, especially when there are costs to be borne by discriminators themselves. It may well be that the racial attitudes and beliefs held by white landlords and realtors in early 20th century Harlem were more hostile to blacks than the attitudes and beliefs of white residents and officials in late 20th century San Francisco and other coastal California areas. But in terms of end results, the actions of the former failed to keep blacks out of Harlem, while the actions of the latter drove out of San Francisco half the blacks already living in that city. Costs matter. Chapter 3. Sorting and Unsorting People. Much empirical evidence suggests that human beings do not interact randomly, nor as frequently or as intensely, with all other human beings as with selected subsets of people like themselves. In short, people sort themselves out, both in where they choose to live and with whom they choose to interact most often and most closely. It is worth examining some of that empirical evidence as to self-sorting before going on to consider the consequences of third-party sorting or unsorting of other people. The crucial point here is that when people spontaneously sort themselves, the results are seldom even or random, and are often quite skewed. Residential sorting and unsorting. Where people live has, at various times and places, been decided either by the people themselves or by others who imposed various restrictions through a variety of institutional devices, ranging from government laws and policies to many private, formal, and informal means